Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are doing our federal news update for Friday, December 19th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And our mission today is, well, it's ambitious. We're going to give you the most granular, comprehensive, and yes, exhaustive report we can on every major action and activity from the U.S. federal government, really just since the beginning of Thursday, December 18th.
And you know, yesterday was... It was much more than just a typical Thursday in Washington.
Far more.
When you look at the sheer volume of these decisions, we're talking executive orders, major judicial rulings, the final passage of key legislation, it feels like a strategic and coordinated clearing of the decks before the holiday recess.
A clearing of the decks. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, because the policies that were cemented yesterday, they signal this fundamental realignment of the government. It's a government that is, on one hand, really aggressive in its commitment to national defense.
Right.
And at the same time, it's deregulatory in the economic sphere, but then conversely, highly restrictive when it comes to social policy.
That structure is, I think, vital for understanding what happened. It really helps organize the chaos. We saw what looked like three major interconnected battlefronts define the day.
Exactly.
First, these massive new executive orders that are fundamentally reshaping our entire approach to space dominance and, of all things, federal drug enforcement.
A huge pivot.
Then you have this highly coordinated administrative and legislative action, almost a pincer movement, targeting healthcare for minors.
Uh-huh.
And finally, these significant, really high-stakes shifts in the federal workforce itself. And that's being driven by court rulings, defense policy, management upheaval. It impacts everything. Federal careers, military procurement, everything.
And look, this wasn't just temporary policymaking. This was a policy consolidation day. The administration used every single lever it had, the presidency, Congress, the regulatory agencies, to create an architecture that is designed to be, if not permanent, then at least extremely difficult to dismantle.
Which is why we need to dig into the details, the specific legal and financial mechanisms they use, because they all have these far-reaching implications, not just for next year, but, I mean, potentially for the next decade.
Potentially.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start at the top with the executive branch. The president used unilateral power to change two vast and, you know, seemingly disparate policy areas in a single day. Space superiority and federal drug enforcement.
Exactly. Let's start with the cosmos. President Trump signed the executive order ensuring American space superiority. And the administration framed this. I thought this was interesting. They framed space capabilities not just as a technology asset, but as a proxy for national vision and willpower.
It's a huge rhetorical shift.
Mm-hmm.
This EO seems to be a dramatic paradigm change, moving the U.S. space strategy away from an emphasis on international cooperation, which really defined the last administration's efforts, to one of just pure dominance.
Pure dominance. And it sets this incredibly aggressive, almost impossible sounding timeline for NASA, something we haven't really seen since the original Apollo program.
So what are the non-negotiable mandates here? What does this new Artemis framework demand?
Well, the centerpiece is this unyielding, really rigid and aggressive timeline. NASA is being ordered to achieve a crewed return to the lunar surface by 2028.
By 2028.
It's very soon.
Yeah.
And critically, the EO explicitly says this is not the end goal. It's a foundational step, and it's designed to support a much larger, more strategic ambition.
Budges.
By 2030, the order mandates the establishment of a permanent lunar outpost. The ultimate goal, and they state this clearly in the policy memo, is to use these lunar assets, especially power generation, resource utilization, as a mandatory proving ground for the eventual journey to Mars.
Right.
It eliminates all ambiguity. The moon is now a logistics hub for Mars, not just a scientific destination.
That timeline alone would require just a massive expenditure of resources.
Yeah.
But the EO doesn't just focus on NASA. And here's where the financial mechanics get, I think, really interesting, because it amended Space Policy Directive 3 from 2018.
Right.
So what was the core change to that directive? And what are the financial implications for you and me and, well, everyone else?
Well, the change fundamentally alters the economics of space traffic management on a global scale. The original 2018 directive, it mandated that space situational awareness data, you know, the critical orbital safety data that tracks debris and satellites, be provided free of direct user fees.
The idea being that this was a public good, essential for global safety.
It was framed exactly as a public good, but this new EO, it just ends that model entirely. It revises the language. It now authorizes those services for commercial and other relevant use. And that little semantic shift immediately ends the public good model. By allowing the government or its contractors to charge for this orbital data, the administration is immediately creating a new and potentially massive revenue stream.
But more importantly, it seems to force the private sector, the new space companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, to take on roles that were previously held by the DoD and NASA.
That's the key. The government is deliberately outsourcing core safety functions to private industry and then paying for it through a commercial mechanism.
How does that work in practice?
The order mandates procuring these services under Part 12 of the Federal Acquisition Regulation, the FAR. And I know that's a critical piece of jargon, but it matters immensely.
Right. Part 12 is for commercial item acquisitions.
Precisely. So by invoking it, the government is signaling that it intends to treat these advanced space services like, I don't know, buying office supplies. It cuts through decades of bureaucratic custom defense contracting rules that usually slow down the acquisition of complex military tech.
Which aligns perfectly with the administration's preference for using the speed of the private sector.
Yeah,
you're
right.
Basically making these new space companies into essential paid infrastructure providers for national security.
That's it. And this commercial pivot is, you know, inextricably linked to the national security component, which is, I mean, terrifyingly explicit in this document. This EO is the formal step toward the militarization of space. We're moving beyond just passive observation.
It really feels like it. The EO explicitly intertwines exploration with hard defense strategy. It mandates the rapid development of prototype next-generation missile defense technologies by 2028.
And that directly references the existing the Iron Dome for America executive order. So this isn't just theory anymore. It's putting hard deadlines on kinetic defensive technology deployment in space.
But the strategic move that really stood out to me was the geography it addresses. It's not just about low Earth orbit anymore.
No, you're right. The directive orders the DoD to detect, characterize, and counter threats in two very strategic and currently kind of underserved geographies. Yeah. The first is very low Earth orbit, which is getting crowded with commercial satellites.
And it's like
the second is far more significant. It's cislunar space. That's the vast, complex, gravity-controlled area between the Earth and the Moon.
So if you control cislunar space,
you control the logistical highway to the Moon and eventually to Mars. It shifts military thinking from traditional high-Earth orbit to controlling a much larger, deeper strategic domain.
And to power this new war-fighting and exploration domain, we also get the most controversial directive in the whole order, nuclear power in space.
Correct. The directive calls for the deployment of nuclear reactors, specifically small modular reactors on the Moon and potentially in orbit. This is to support these incredibly energy-intensive military and scientific operations.
Because solar just won't cut it for missile defense systems.
Not for that. Or for industrial operations on the Moon, they require vastly more energy than solar arrays can provide. So this is a massive, costly, and politically sensitive escalation. It moves the U.S. beyond passive satellite support to active defense and power generation in deep space.
And tying this all back to the private sector point, this EO was signed right as Jared Isaacman, the billionaire entrepreneur known for his private space missions, was confirmed as the new NASA administrator.
And that appointment is, I mean, it's symbolic, right? It reflects a clear preference for private sector disruption. His history with these high-profile commercial space ventures, it just coincides perfectly with an EO that favors commercial solutions and uses government funding procured under that Part 12 of the FAR to incentivize the market.
So NASA, under this administration, is expected to act less like a traditional research agency.
And more like a large, innovative funding body for private space corporations. It's about accelerating their tech development for national security purposes.
Okay, so from the cosmos to controlled substances, let's make that pivot. The president also signed an executive order making a historic change in federal drug enforcement. It's called Increasing Medical Marijuana and Cannabidiol Research. This is a deeply complex issue, right? Balancing medical access with law enforcement.
It is. And this EO directs the Attorney General to expedite the rescheduling of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule the 3rd under the Controlled Substances Act, the CSA. Now, the move is heavily supported by patient advocacy groups, especially veterans who are suffering from chronic pain and seizure disorders.
But the president was very clear this is not legalization.
He was explicit. He emphasized that this EO is not an endorsement of recreational use, but a necessary step for medical progress.
That shift is profound. I mean, under Schedule 1, cannabis is grouped with drugs like heroin and LSD, with the formal federal finding that it has a high potential for abuse. And, this is the key part, no accepted medical use. So what does moving it to Schedule 3rd actually mean for its legal status?
Well, moving to Schedule 3rd is a change in federal classification that carries enormous weight. Schedule 3 drugs are formally acknowledged to have a moderate to low potential for physical or psychological dependence and, crucially, an accepted medical use.
Like what? What's another Schedule 3 drug?
Think Tylenol with codeine or anabolic steroids. The move is explicitly framed as necessary to improve research. The current schedule restrictions, they make clinical trials prohibitively expensive and difficult. It leaves American patients and doctors without the robust, federally recognized scientific guidance they need.
So it allows the administration to champion medical freedom and patient access.
Without having to take on the massive political battle of full recreational legalization.
Medically necessary, but still heavily controlled. But the immediate, and I mean massive, impact here is economic. For the multi-billion dollar legal cannabis industry, it all seems to hinge on a single section of the Internal Revenue Code.
Section 280E. And yes, that section is the absolute scourge of the cannabis industry. It was enacted back in the 80s to target drug traffickers, preventing them from claiming tax deductions on illegal business expenses.
And because cannabis is currently Schedule 1 or 2, state legal cannabis companies can't deduct ordinary business expenses. Things like rent, payroll, marketing.
That's right. And the consequence of that is that these businesses face effective tax rates that are often upwards of 60 or even 70%.
70%.
Yeah. Many companies, even though they're generating millions in revenue, they struggle to be profitable because of this crushing tax burden. Rescheduling cannabis to Schedule 3rd eliminates 280E's applicability completely.
Oh, wow.
Legal and financial analysts are predicting this move will unlock hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Some estimates go as high as $600 million in cash flow for these firms. This one administrative change is the single largest financial boost the legal cannabis industry has ever seen. It provides immediate stabilization to a sector that has been, you know, incredibly volatile.
That is immense. And the EO also tackled CBD, which is chemically distinct, but has been in this strange legal gray area since the Farm Bill passed.
It did. And this is where they're trying to thread a very specific technical needle. The EO authorizes Medicare to reimburse certain physician-prescribed CBD treatments starting in April 2026. It's part of a groundbreaking pilot program.
So this is the first time federal insurance money is authorized for cannabinoid therapies.
Right. It legitimizes the substance within mainstream federal health care. But, and this is a big but, the administration is trying to distinguish between therapeutic CBD and intoxicating derivatives of hemp.
How are they drawing that line?
The EO explicitly orders Congress to work to restrict intoxicating hemp, like Delta-8 THC, which has psychoactive properties, while at the same time protecting access to full-spectrum CBD.
So they're trying to close the Delta-8 loophole while propping up the CBD market.
Exactly. Delta-8 is often chemically derived from hemp, but it acts very similarly to traditional marijuana. By restricting it, they're trying to curb recreational use through that loophole while ensuring that the non-intoxicating, potentially therapeutic, full-spectrum CBD remains accessible for this new Medicare program. It's a highly nuanced regulatory approach.
So you have this classic bifurcated drug policy emerging. On one hand, you're corporatizing and liberalizing cannabis for research in the economy via rescheduling.
And on the other hand, you're simultaneously declaring war on synthetic opioids. The counter-drug action was formalized at the exact same time. December 18th also saw the formal publication in the Federal Register of the Executive Order, designating fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction.
A WMD. That designation is far more than symbolic.
Oh, it's an immense escalation.
What specific authorities does designating fentanyl as a WMD unlock for the federal government?
It allows the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense to bypass traditional law enforcement protocols and use counter-WMD authorities to interdict the opioid. This means applying capabilities usually reserved for, you know, biological, chemical, or nuclear threats.
Like what?
Like highly advanced intelligence gathering, global logistics tracking, interdiction operations that could happen outside traditional maritime boundaries. It elevates the drug war to a national security threat level. It gives agencies greater surveillance power and military-style resources for interdiction, particularly focused on foreign manufacturing and smuggling networks.
This juxtaposition, it's really something. Moving cannabis toward medical acceptance while using military-grade security systems against fentanyl, it truly captures the administration's strategic imperatives.
It shows a very clear prioritization. You promote economic liberalization where it's politically palatable, and cannabis rescheduling does that. It frees up industry capital and supports veterans while applying maximum militarized pressure on what they deem a catastrophic national security threat, which is fentanyl.
That sets the stage perfectly for the next major area of action. Because these ambitious policy shifts, they require a functional government. Which brings us to the internal chaos facing the federal workforce, which saw several key judicial and administrative decisions yesterday.
That's right. The residue from that recent 43-day government shutdown is still impacting federal careers and management authority. And we saw a major judicial ruling come down on December 17th, reported yesterday, concerning hundreds of employees who were targeted by reduction in force, or RIF, layoffs.
Tell us about the ruling from Judge Susan Ilston in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California.
Judge Ilston signed a preliminary injunction, and this is a crucial temporary ruling that immediately orders four federal agencies to rescind all RIF notices that were issued and finalized during that shutdown period, specifically between October 1st and November 12th.
So how many employees and which agencies are now scrambling to comply with this?
The injunction covers approximately 680 federal employees in total, and the agencies have been given until December 23rd to comply. This is not a small logistical lift.
No.
It includes nearly 250 Foreign Service officers at the State Department, 150 employees in the crucial Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, and about 200 employees split between the General Services Administration and the Small Business Administration.
The core legal argument here, pushed by the unions, was that these RIFs were illegal because Congress had already spoken on the matter in the continuing resolution that ended the shutdown.
And that's the absolute crux of the decision. The unions successfully argued that Congress's mandate in that continuing resolution was clear and unambiguous. It explicitly stated that any RIFs implemented between those dates shall have no force or effect.
And it barred any further RIFs for a period of time.
Exactly. It barred further RIFs through January 30th, 2026. The injunction affirms that mandate, citing the chaotic nature of these RIFs and emphasizing that Congress intended to nullify them and provide stability. The court agreed with the unions that allowing the RIFs to stand constituted real and ongoing harm. They even cited employee affidavits detailing things like eviction notices and inability to pay medical bills.
Now, the administration, through the Department of Justice, strongly objected. They argued that this judicial intervention was administrative overreach. What was the DOJ's rationale?
The DOJ attorney, Brad Rosenberg, he warned the court that reversing 680 RIFs now would be, in his words, logistically a big lift for the agencies, a massive administrative headache right in the middle of the holidays.
But his central argument was more strategic.
Right. It was. He said if appellate courts were to later stay or vacate Judge Ilston's ruling, the agencies would be forced to start the entire RIF process over again, losing months of time and effort. He called it awfully hard to unscramble that egg.
So the administration wanted these employees to go through the Merit Systems Protection Board case by case.
Right, rather than a broad, immediate injunction. They framed the RIFs as the administration just carrying out its lawful policy objectives.
It really highlights the significant instability facing the federal workforce, especially when you look at major agencies that are simultaneously undergoing these massive internal reorganizations, most notably at the IRS, which is trying to modernize its whole technology function.
Oh, the IRS IT restructuring is a defining example of this internal disruption. We got granular details on the workforce shifts yesterday. Approximately 1,000 IRS IT employees are being directed to reassignments.
1,000 employees. Where are they going?
They're being moved out of the Chief Information Officer, the CIO organization, and into the Chief Operating Officer, or COO, organization. And the effective date is December 28th. The notice they got was incredibly specific and disruptive.
In what way?
They were told explicitly that they are no longer working on IRS IT projects. Their mandate now is solely to complete an orderly transition of their current work by January 9th.
So they're being moved without a permanent job assignment. This is like an internal temporary holding batter.
That's exactly what it is. The agency told them this is a permanent realignment out of the CIO organization, but then clarified it is not a permanent realignment into the COO organization. They are essentially being placed in this limbo state. They've been asked to upload their resumes by January 23rd for potential roles across the entire IRS and Treasury Department.
The anxiety must be immense.
Immense, especially since some of these employees were also subject to the RIF notices that were later rescinded, a double dose of career uncertainty.
And this chaos seems driven by a specific high-level management philosophy championed by the administration.
It is. It's part of the philosophy championed by Treasury CIO Sam Korkos. He's been very vocal. The administration believes the current IRS IT workforce doesn't have the necessary skills for modern tax administration. Korkos has previously defended RAFs as a necessary scalpel, arguing that the agency needs to move away from tenure-based separations toward performance-based evaluations to rebuild the technical function.
But he acknowledges the risk in that, right?
Yeah.
That you lose your top performers.
He does. He's acknowledged that RIFs often result in losing younger top performers who have the most marketable skills, but he sees the disruption as necessary to inject new modern talent.
And what does this new IRS IT structure even look like, the one that's prompting this massive shift?
A December 15th internal memo detailed the first major IT restructuring at the IRS in over 20 years. They're replacing the legacy structure of associate CIOs with a system of four mission-focused verticals.
What are they?
They are taxpayer services and online accounts, tax processing, compliance, and filing season and legislative deliver. On top of that, they're establishing five foundational areas like cybersecurity and data and platform engineering. The entire goal is to simplify the structure and strengthen the direct connection between technical work and the agency's core tax administration functions.
That is bureaucratic disruption on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, moving from the IRS to the State Department, we also saw a reorganization focused not on people, but on procurement strategy.
Yes, this is an effort to make the State Department a more strategic buyer. The department has elevated its procurement office into a brand new Bureau of Global Acquisitions. And this is far more than a name change. It's a structural move. It's designed to ensure the acquisition function has a voice in senior leadership decisions.
And a key goal here is adopting something called a category management model.
Right, which is a long-term governmental goal that this administration has aggressively accelerated. Category management is all about centralization and specialization. Instead of every division buying independently, you focus your procurement efforts across four major high-value spending buckets.
Which for state would be?
For state, it's IT, professional services, diplomatic security services, and overseas construction. The idea is to centralize buying power, aggregate demand across the globe, and create these specialized cadres of contracting officers who build deep expertise. It moves the agency from being reactive and transactional to being strategic and efficient.
We see that same focus on modernization, particularly in tech acquisition, at the DoD with their Software Fast Track or SWFT initiative. Yeah.
This is a major priority for the Pentagon, driven by acting DoD CIO Katie Arrington. Her stated goal is, well, it's revolutionary. She famously wants to blow up the RMF, the legacy risk management framework, and move away from the rigid authority to operate or ATO process.
For our listeners who may not be defense contractors, can you quickly define those concepts? What are the RMF and ATO?
Sure. The risk management framework, the RMF, is the Pentagon's traditional, incredibly lengthy checklist process for determining if a piece of software is secure enough to be deployed. The authority to operate, the ATO, is that final, official, time-consuming green light from a high-level official. That process can often take months, sometimes years.
And Arrington wants to replace that slow, one-time approval with something more dynamic.
Exactly. Continuous authorization, meaning software security is constantly assessed and updated, rather than being frozen in time by a single approval stamp.
That sounds necessary. But the defense industry is signaling that the implementation of SWFT has hit a major roadblock.
It has. Industry feedback compiled by the DoD CIO's office points to a crippling lack of consistent and standardized methods for attestation processes. Vendors want to move fast, but they're confused about the rules of engagement.
They don't know what documentation the DoD requires to prove they're compliant.
Right. What qualifies as a valid attestation? Can companies self-attest their security, or do they have to rely on expensive, time-consuming third parties? This regulatory uncertainty makes compliance inconsistent across the department, even though vendors are willing to provide things like software bills of materials or SBOMs.
So DoD has the vision to move fast, but they haven't clarified the rules for vendors. The old bureaucracy of compliance, even if the framework changes, is still tripping them up. That friction seems to mirror the legal and ethical tension facing federal employees and the military right now.
It absolutely does. Let's look at the whistleblower situation at FEMA. Yesterday, senior House Democrats called on the Office of Special Counsel, the OSC, to launch an investigation into potential whistleblower retaliation.
This centers on the 14 FEMA staff who signed the Katrina Declaration, a public letter criticizing agency changes. What's the latest twist in their ordeal?
These staff were initially placed on administrative leave. They were briefly reinstated earlier this month, but then they were almost immediately placed back on administrative leave. And the critical detail here is that this happened despite an internal FEMA legal counsel finding that their original disclosure, the Katrina Declaration itself, was protected speech under both the Whistleblower Protection Act and the First Amendment.
So the internal lawyers at FEMA concluded the whistleblowers were protected, but political leadership overrode that finding and resuspended them anyway.
That is the direct conflict. Democrats are now urging the OSC to find clear evidence of retaliation, reinstate the employees permanently, and pursue disciplinary action against the officials involved. The Homeland Security spokesperson, however, is defending the action, claiming the earlier reinstatement was wrongly and without authorization by bureaucrats acting outside their authority.
That's a very messy situation.
It puts employees in an impossible position regarding their ethical and legal duties.
And we saw a similar ethical tension, this time between political leadership and policy standards, appear in the military nominations. Senator Jackie Rosen, a Democrat from Nevada, placed a significant hold on Admiral Kevin Lunde's nomination for Coast Guard Commandant yesterday.
Right, and the hold is explicitly due to concerns that the Coast Guard backtracked on a commitment regarding policy language for hate symbols. Senator Rosen asserts that despite an earlier memo assuring that hate symbols would be prohibited, the final agency-wide policy describes symbols like swastikas and nooses as merely potentially divisive.
Not explicitly banned as hate symbols.
Exactly.
Why is that semantic difference, potentially divisive versus banned as hate symbols, so important that it warrants holding up a commandant nomination?
It all comes down to intent and enforcement. A symbol that's deemed potentially divisive requires a much greater administrative effort to prove malice or disruption before you can take action. A symbol that is explicitly banned as a hate symbol offers immediate grounds for disciplinary action. It sends an unambiguous signal about the service's values.
So Senator Rosen and her allies believe the weaker language allows the symbols to persist.
That's the argument. While DHS insists the final policy strengthens their ability to prosecute, the failure to use that explicit hate symbol language is seen as a betrayal of trust, enough to pause the confirmation.
That policy confusion brings us to the broader national discussion on military ethics that saw a renewed focus yesterday. The high-stakes, complex issue of following lawful versus unlawful orders.
Yes, Frank Rosenblatt, a prominent expert in military justice, he emphasized the core challenge for every single military member. They're operating on a high-wire act. They have a clear legal duty to disobey orders that are manifestly unlawful.
And what's the definition of manifestly unlawful?
An order that an ordinary person of reasonable sense and understanding would know immediately without needing a lawyer that I'm just not allowed to do this. It's an order that is obviously criminal or clearly beyond the scope of military authority. Like, an order to intentionally execute a prisoner would be manifestly unlawful.
But the complexity comes in the execution, especially in these boundary-pushing, high-pressure environments like the recent boat strikes in the Caribbean or National Guard deployments during civil unrest.
That is the crux of it. The consequences for being wrong are severe. If a service member refuses an order that's later deemed lawful, they face court-martial. If they execute an order that's later deemed unlawful, they can be prosecuted for that too.
So what's the solution?
Rosenblatt stressed that in real-time, high-pressure scenarios, service members don't have time to call a lawyer. The ultimate solution, he argued, isn't more legal briefings. It's rigorous, scenario-based practice and training to build rapid competence and help them understand the specific boundaries of their behavior under stress. It's about muscle memory and ethical discipline, not just legal texts.
That focus on defense, personnel, and procurement provides a perfect segue into the legislative powerhouse that dominated December 18th. The $901 billion National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, for fiscal year 2026. This bill is the statutory vehicle that defines military policy for the next year.
And the Senate gave final passage with a commanding 77-20 vote on the 17th, and the president signed it into law on the 18th. This massive piece of legislation, it codifies the administration's peace through strength agenda and ensures the continuity of several key military strategies.
Okay, let's get into the specifics of what this $901 billion NDAA mandates. Let's start with personnel and the centerpiece of the defense spending.
For personnel, it authorizes a 3.8% military pay raise for 2026, which is crucial for retaining talent. But the strategic centerpiece is the Comprehensive National Missile Defense System, which is legislatively named the Golden Dome. This is the permanent funded legislative name for the executive's Iron Dome for America concept.
And what does the NDAA authorize for this Golden Dome in terms of hardware and deployment?
It includes unprecedented authority for multi-year procurement of defense assets. Specifically, it mandates acquiring 10 new interceptors, with earmarked funding for expansion of sites in Alaska and potentially new sites in the Midwest. And crucially, it authorizes the purchase of vast quantities of both PAC-3 and THAAD missiles over seven-year horizons.
So you have a layered defense.
A layered defense architecture. The PAC-3 is the shorter-range terminal phase interceptor designed to hit missiles right before they strike. The THAAD system intercepts at a much higher altitude. Funding both ensures you can counter both regional and intercontinental threats.
A unique and, I think, strategically important feature of this NDAA is its political durability. It actively converts existing, sometimes controversial, executive policy into permanent law.
This is the administration's strategy for bulletproofing its policies against potential future executive reversal. By converting over a dozen executive orders into permanent law, the policies are functionally permanent for a decade. It would require congressional action to undo them, not just a future presidential signature.
Like what? What's an example?
Well, it includes the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, offices and trainings across the DOD. According to the Republican-controlled House Armed Services Committee, that saves the Pentagon about $40 million. More broadly, it includes $1.6 billion in cuts to climate change-related programs and mandate spending increases for border security tech.
On the foreign policy front, Congress used the NDAA to assert its oversight. It inserted minimum troop levels that push back on the president's perceived preference for troop withdrawals.
This is a direct response to past surprise decisions, like the sudden troop reductions in Germany or Syria. The NDAA requires maintaining minimum troop levels, at least 76,000 U.S. troops in Europe and 28,500 in South Korea.
And they can't be withdrawn without congressional consultation.
Right. Not unless NATO allies are consulted and Congress has provided detailed justification. Lawmakers also authorized $400 million a year for the next 2 years to manufacture weapons for Ukraine, ensuring continuous support. These provisions really signal Congress asserting its war powers.
And then there's a massive domestic power expansion hidden in this defense bill, something with major implications for civil liberties and domestic policing. The Safer Skies Act.
This is a critical development for domestic law enforcement and infrastructure protection. The Safer Skies Act dramatically expands the authority to interdict, jam, or even destroy drones. Previously, this authority was limited to select federal agencies like DHS, DOD, and the FBI, and usually only near airports or federal landmarks.
So who gets this expanded authority now?
The NDAA extends this authority to state, local, tribal, and territorial law enforcement and correctional agencies. This is a nationalization of power that was previously held federally. The administration and Congress argue it's necessary to address the proliferation of drones used for prison contraband, drug deliveries, and infrastructure surveillance.
So the why care here for you listening is that if you live near a large prison or a critical infrastructure site, your local police now have the authority to disrupt the airspace in ways they never could before. That raises immediate Fourth Amendment concerns about surveillance and localized air control.
Exactly. It establishes this kind of Fortress America mentality, hardening borders against both military threats, like missiles, and localized threats, like commercial drone swarms. It essentially federalizes a new level of domestic security response.
Now, despite signing this massive policy-codifying bill, the president immediately signaled that he might not actually follow all of it.
This is the constitutional tension. The president issued a signing statement asserting that several NDAA provisions, specifically those restricting his ability to unilaterally decide troop withdrawals and diplomatic negotiations, are unconstitutional encroachments on executive power. By treating them as advisory, not mandatory, he's setting the stage for a future conflict with Congress.
And reinforcing the unitary executive theory.
Absolutely. The theory that asserts near total control over the executive branch and foreign policy.
Let's talk finances and transparency, because one of the president's announcements this week regarding military pay turned out to be less than advertised.
Yes, the president announced a warrior dividend of 1,776 SIGS members, and he suggested it was a patriotic bonus funded by excess tariff revenues secured by his trade policies. That turned out to be a classic political deception.
So what's the fiscal reality of the warrior dividend?
It's actually a one-time basic allowance for housing, or BAH stipend, that was already appropriated by Congress back in July. In the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, Congress appropriated $2.9 billion to supplement BAH to address rising housing costs. The Pentagon is now disbursing $2.6 billion of that already existing money as a one-time payment to roughly 1.45 million service members.
So it's not new money? And it's not funded by tariffs. It's money Congress already approved for housing relief, just repurposed and rebranded as a dividend.
That's the core fact. I mean, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth correctly framed it as a quality of life improvement, but the political packaging misrepresented the source and nature of the funding.
And this friction between the Pentagon and Congress over transparency, it extends directly to the controversial military operations near Venezuela.
Absolutely. The NDAA included specific retaliatory language aimed at increasing oversight. It threatened to withhold a quarter of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's travel budget until he provides Congress with unedited video and the specific authorizing orders for those controversial boat strikes on alleged drug vessels near Venezuela.
Why is Congress demanding this level of detail? And why is the Pentagon resisting?
The primary reason is the shifting rationale for the operation. It's created intense confusion and distrust on Capitol Hill, especially after a strike in September that allegedly killed two people. Initially, the operations were framed purely around interdicting drugs.
Counter-narco-terrorism.
Right. Then, administration officials suggested the goal was putting pressure on the Nicolas Maduro regime. And most recently, the president mentioned the operation in the context of taking back American oil rights in Venezuela, which holds 17% of global oil reserves.
So the goalposts keep moving, from narco-terrorism to regime change to resource recovery.
And that has created deep alarm, forcing Congress to use its financial leverage to demand clear, unedited documentation of authorization and execution.
That's a fascinating look at the internal and external pressures on the military. Let's shift now to domestic policy, focusing on the rapid regulatory and legislative movement on social and economic fronts, especially the highly coordinated action targeting health care for minors.
We are witnessing a textbook execution of what policy analysts call the pincer movement strategy. On December 18th, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, launched a regulatory blitz led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., while the House simultaneously passed criminalizing legislation. The goal is to enforce this policy through two irreversible channels, financial coercion and criminal law.
Let's detail the HHS administrative actions first, taken by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS.
So CMS issued two, devastating proposed rules, and they're relying heavily on a recent HHS report that argues gender-affirming care for minors, which is now formally labeled sex-rejecting procedures, causes irreversible damage and is based on junk science.
The first rule is about Medicaid funding.
Right. It proposes to simply prohibit federal Medicaid funds from being used for these procedures on minors. But the second rule is the nuclear option.
Tell us about the massive condition of participation rule. Why is that one so powerful?
The condition of participation rule is the ultimate leverage tool because federal funding is the oxygen most hospitals need to survive. Virtually every hospital in the U.S. accepts Medicare and Medicaid. This proposed rule would bar any hospital that accepts any of those funds from performing these procedures on children as a condition of participation.
So it acts as a de facto nationwide ban through economic coercion.
Exactly. Even if a state passes a law protecting this type of care, hospitals in that state would be forced to comply with the federal rule or face financial ruin by losing access to Medicare and Medicaid patients. It's an aggressive and strategic use of federal spending power to impose social policy nationwide.
The FDA piled on with corresponding enforcement actions.
They did. They targeted the non-medical, social aspects of gender transition. The FDA issued warning letters to 12 breast binder manufacturers and retailers. These letters allege the companies are illegally marketing these products as medical devices to treat gender dysphoria in minors without getting the necessary regulatory approvals.
And all of this was perfectly complemented by the House of Representatives' legislative blitz, creating that pincer effect you mentioned.
The House passed H.R. 3492, the Protect Children's Innocence Act, by a narrow vote of 216 to 211. And this bill is severe. It criminalizes the provision of certain gender transition treatments for minors as a Class C felony,
which carries penalties of up to 10 years in federal prison for doctors, nurses, or counselors.
Exactly. The immediate consequence of this legislative and administrative pincer movement is that the ACLU has already vowed an aggressive legal challenge. They're claiming the proposals target cruel and unconstitutional interference with what they define as evidence-based medically necessary care. The legal fight is now set to be immense.
Okay, moving from social policy to economic deregulation, the same House also moved swiftly on environmental policy. They passed the Standardizing, Permitting, and Expediting Economic Development, or SPEED Act.
The SPEED Act passed 221 to 196. This bill fundamentally targets the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which industry groups have long argued slows down critical infrastructure projects. NEPA is the law that requires federal agencies to study and disclose the environmental impacts of their major actions.
And what is the key regulatory reform in the SPEED Act that weakens NEPA?
The core reform clarifies that federal funding alone does not automatically trigger a full NEPA review. Previously, if any federal money touched a project, it could necessitate a massive, multi-year environmental impact statement. The SPEED Act also imposes hard deadlines and strict judicial limits on how long environmental challenges can drag out in court. Manufacturers and energy groups, as you can imagine, strongly endorsed it.
And they also moved on wildlife management with the gray wolf delisting.
Yes. The House passed a bill 211 to 204 to require the Department of Interior to remove the gray wolf from the Endangered Species Act list, returning management authority entirely to the states. Proponents argued this returns power to local agencies and prevents what they call ballot box biology.
But opponents warn that this disregards prevailing science.
They do. They warn it could lead to a rapid population decline, undoing decades of conservation progress by state-level policies that might be less stringent than the federal protections.
And before we move on from the legislative side, we have to address the largest looming financial crisis hitting millions of Americans. The Affordable Care Act subsidies are set to expire at the end of the month.
This is an incredibly high-stakes political conflict. Democrats, led by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, are demanding an immediate vote to extend the enhanced premium tax credits. If these expire, premiums would skyrocket for an estimated 22 million Americans who get their insurance through the ACA exchanges.
But House Speaker Mike Johnson adjourned the House for the holidays, effectively stopping any immediate vote. This was a strategic political calculation.
It was. The House discharge petition, which aims to force a vote on the extension, did secure the necessary 218 signatures, including four Republicans. But by adjourning, Speaker Johnson ensured the petition won't be enacted until January. Republicans are using the threat of 22 million premiums skyrocketing as bargaining leverage for other priorities when Congress reconvenes.
And the administration's position is, well, it's deeply conflicted on the ACA.
It remains unclear. The president has stated he would prefer direct payments to people, bypassing the insurance companies entirely. But CMS Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz pointed to new enrollment data suggesting the federal exchanges aren't imploding. He claims this speaks to the fact that ACA plans are already heavily subsidized. The ultimate decision has been successfully pushed into 2026, leaving millions in limbo.
Beyond the large legislative bills, we saw several other significant executive and judicial actions related to federal compensation and oversight that wrapped up the day.
That's right. The president signed an executive order finalizing a 1% federal pay raise for most General Schedule civilian employees in 2026. This aligns with his alternative pay plan from back in August and is notable because it's the smallest annual increase since 2021. Critically, it does not include a locality pay adjustment for most workers.
And a slight holiday reprieve amidst all this chaos.
A small one. The president issued an order granting federal employees two additional days off next week, December 24th and 26th, effectively creating a five-day Christmas weekend for most, although critical agencies must remain operational.
We also saw the administration's focus on the bureaucracy, especially in technology acquisition and IT staffing, continue to generate internal focus.
Federal CIO Greg Barbaccia detailed his top three priorities for 2026. Paramount is hiring a qualified technology workforce, followed by improving software licensing practices, and finally, securing the foundation of government technology. The emphasis on attracting talent, particularly young innovators, is being supported by new programs like OPM's Semester of Service Volunteer Program.
Meanwhile, the ongoing effort to clean up the federal acquisition process scored a major win in the NDAA, specifically regarding GSA contracts.
This is a massive administrative relief for contractors. The NDAA contained a provision GSA had long requested. changing the statutory standard for the GSA schedule program from lowest overall cost alternative to best value. This change is designed to permanently kill the much-hated price reduction clause.
Why did contractors hate the price reduction clause so much?
It required vendors to promise the government their absolute lowest price at all times. If they ever offered a lower price to a private customer, they were forced to retroactively offer that same lowest price to the government. It created immense administrative and legal risk. GSA believes changing the standard to best value will increase competition and reduce the administrative burden.
And while the federal government is trying to restructure its internal purchasing, we also saw a major development in corporate national security revolving around the social media giant, TikTok.
The parent company, ByteDance, signed a series of binding agreements to sell its U.S. arm into a joint venture that will be majority owned by American investors. TikTok's global U.S. entities will manage global products and commercial activities, seemingly satisfying some security concerns.
But a key sticking point for U.S. lawmakers remains the algorithm itself.
Absolutely. The agreement states the algorithm used for U.S. users will be a copy derived from ByteDance's master algorithm. This copy will then be retrained and walled off under the direct supervision of Oracle, the American tech partner, but it's not being created from scratch.
Which raises concerns about hidden backdoors.
Exactly. Lawmakers and intelligence experts remain concerned that because the algorithm originates from ByteDance, there could be ongoing influence, raising concerns about access to U.S. user data and foreign manipulation.
Finally, we saw litigation designed to protect federal oversight move forward, specifically against the Trump administration's attempts to defund the Council of the Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency, or CIBIG.
This lawsuit, filed by a coalition of nonprofits, argues that the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, is illegally withholding funds from CISEA. CIGI is the central body that supports, trains, and ensures the independence of Inspector General offices across the entire government. OMB first declined to apportion funding in September, claiming without detail that the IGs were corrupt. The lawsuit is a critical effort to legally protect this crucial oversight body and ensure its continued independence from political pressure.
Okay, as we synthesize the scale of December 18th, a day just packed with immense activity, it's clear this was the day of aggressive policy consolidation. What's the single largest takeaway for you regarding the strategic imperatives that defined the day?
The overarching theme is the synchronization of power to consolidate a specific governance model. We're seeing two major strategies at play: aggressive external expansion and aggressive internal disruption. The primary strategic imperative is the effective use of the pincer movement.
We saw that with social policy on healthcare.
Exactly. Attacking a policy area, gender-affirming care for minors, from two directions simultaneously: legislative criminalization and executive funding prohibition via that CMS condition of participation rule. It gives opponents nowhere to hide, even in states that might try to create legal sanctuaries, because the economic coercion of Medicare and Medicaid funding is inescapable.
And that strategic imperative extends to the massive privatization of national security assets as well.
Absolutely. This is the second great theme. The space EO shifted orbital data from a public good to a commercial revenue stream procured under FAVR-HAR Part 12, paving the way for private companies to become paid infrastructure providers for defense and exploration. We are seeing the defense apparatus merge with the commercial space market.
And the same underlying philosophy is driving the discussion on air traffic control reform.
Yes. Proponents argue that moving air traffic control out of the federal budget and into a user fee-funded nonprofit corporation, like they've done successfully in Canada and the UK, would insulate capital investment from political shutdowns and encourage rapid innovation like adopting remote tower technology, which the FAA has been historically too risk-averse to adopt.
It's this constant merger of policy goals with commercial opportunity.
From space superiority to drug tax relief. This is a reshaping of Washington that isn't necessarily shrinking the government, but fundamentally shifting where influence, responsibility, and financial opportunity reside.
It's the ultimate tension, a simultaneous demand for stability and profound disruption. The administration is focused on cutting bureaucratic elements it dislikes, but it's also trying to inject new, highly skilled, mission-driven talent through programs like the OPM's new internships and the Noble Reach Scholars.
And this is what makes the future of public service so fascinating and, well, fraught. We're demanding the next generation of public servants be innovative and mission-driven, ready to tackle complex issues like AI or modern IT. Yet they are entering a system defined by chaotic reorganization, like those 1,000 IRS IT employees being shuffled into limbo or the FEMA whistleblowers being suspended despite legal protection.
That intersection of chaotic management and a demand for cutting-edge commitment creates a very interesting tension for anyone considering a federal career today.
Which raises an important final question for you, the listener, to consider as you digest this massive shift. Given the dramatic policy swings, the judicial challenges, and the reorganization chaos hitting foundational agencies like the IRS, FEMA, and the Coast Guard, how will the next generation define public service? Is it still the promise of a stable, lifelong career? Or is it rapidly transitioning into something fundamentally different? A temporary stop, a place to inject innovation for a few years, before returning to the stability and predictability of the private sector? When the foundational systems of Washington are constantly shifting, what is the core mission that truly endures for the people working inside it?
That is a huge question to consider, and a perfect final thought for this deep dive into the federal news update for Friday, December 19th, 2025.